is a bottle of Minute Maid Pomegranate Blueberry Blend. See the pomegranate? Well, it turns out the stuff has almost no pomegranate juice in it. In fact, it has less than a tablespoon of pomegranate juice. We wondered how people would react if you showed them exactly what they were buying.
I'm down here trying to get your pomegranate juice, and you know, every bottle has like maybe a tablespoon of juice in it.
Why is there no juice in here?
Well, I mean, technically there is. There's almost a tablespoon of pomegranate juice there, so.
That's it?
Yeah, that's how much Minute Maid puts in their pomegranate blueberry blend.
Are you serious? Is that even legal?
An attack ad from Palm Wonderful, the company that prides itself on selling 100% pomegranate juice. The company is suing Coca-Cola over its Minute Maid version of a similar drink, which Palm says contains only a tiny bit of actual pomegranate juice. The Supreme Court is hearing arguments in the case today. Palm is owned by Stuart and Linda Resnick, L.A. billionaires who've donated a lot of money to the arts here. The Resnick Pavilion, for example, at LACMA was one of their donations. Joining us now to sort out the details of the case is Dahlia Lithwick. She covers the courts for Slate.com. Hi, Dahlia.
Hey there, Madeline.
All right, so Palm says Minute Maid is misleading the public because its pomegranate blueberry juice isn't really pomegranate or blueberry, that it's in fact 99.4% apple and grape juices. So what is Coca-Cola, the makers of Minute Maid, what do they say to this?
Well, they say that they're complying, and I think it's agreed that they are complying with the federal labeling laws, that the FDA says we don't determine the content of our juice by volume. It's by taste, and by taste, there's some pomegranate in there. And so the federal law is what it is, and it doesn't say you have to, you know, lay it out by proportion of different juices. And so really this suit is kind of a question of whether the FDA labeling rules trump other lawsuits. In other words, do the FDA rules close the door to anyone else that the Palm company sued under something called the Lanham Act, which doesn't allow you to willfully mislead your consumers? Companies can sue other companies under the Lanham Act, but this suit goes away if it turns out that the FDA rules trump. And the FDA rules, there are good reasons for it to trump, because otherwise everybody runs around suing everybody. The FDA rules create, even though it may be a false standard, a unitary, coherent standard that everybody adheres to.
So why would the court then wade into this?
Well, the Ninth Circuit ruled against Palm. They said, look, you know, private groups can't go around suing. The FDA rule is what it is. The court presumably takes the case to sort of say, we're going to have to make a determination. The language that's used here is whether those FDA labeling rules are a floor or a ceiling. In other words, you can go beyond them and say, this may comply with the FDA rules, but it's still misleading, or whether the FDA rules kind of occupy the entire field so that other folks can't get into the business of suing. It's really, really an incredibly important case for businesses and advertisers who need to know whether they have to comply with the FDA rules or whether there's some other test that they need to meet, whether it's under the Lanham Act or something else. So again, I think it's a really critical case in terms of giving a coherent answer to businesses about what they can put on their labels.
Right. And so then is this also a referendum on the FDA itself, and will they have to defend themselves in front of the justices?
Well, you know, it was interesting. At oral argument this morning, I wasn't at the court, but it looked as though actually the justices were leaning towards supporting Palm's claims that they have a place in being in this fight and telling Minute Maid by way of Coke, you know, that it's just not enough to comply with just the FDA rules, that you're going to have to do more. So we don't know, and it's never wise to judge based on what the justices say. But it did look as though the court was leaning toward the notion that maybe the FDA rules are not enough.
Well, ironically, Palm is also defending itself against similar claims brought by the Federal Trade Commission, basically saying Palm has made these misleading health claims on their products.
That's right. Palm got into trouble with the FTC. They found that some of the claims that the Palm folks were making on their products were deceptive. The Resnick Blessem spent $35 million to produce 100 studies and still couldn't prove their claims that their pomegranate juice and their pills could prevent heart disease, prostate cancer, and erectile dysfunction. Mm-hmm. And so now they've really been told by the courts that for the next couple of years, their company is going to have to send advertising and promotional material to the FTC for pre-approval. Palm was saying some pretty crazy things, Madeline. They were really saying that, you know, we are 40% as effective as Viagra. Pomegranate juice is just that good. And so I think that the FTC felt that they needed to rein in some of their claims.
Well, has Palm acknowledged the similarities between the two cases?
Not that I've seen. I mean, I think, you know, it is kind of ironic that they're being spanked on one side for false claims and then turning around and spanking Minute Maid. I think that they would probably say that what Minute Maid is doing by calling itself pomegranate blueberry juice when less than 0.5% of the contents are, in fact, pomegranate blueberry juice is more egregious. But certainly it is a little bit of a case of false claims all around.
So let's say the Supreme Court does side with Palm. What does this mean for us when we go to the grocery store?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's important to say this is just applies to names and labels. This doesn't apply to claims made about the product. But I think that the folks who are siding, a lot of folks are siding with Coca-Cola and Minute Maid in this case, are saying what it's going to mean is that what was formerly like a clear standard whereby everybody knew that the FDA rules were the only game in town, it's going to mean a lot more confusion. There's going to be a lot more companies suing companies. In fact, that's really the fear that it's going to open a floodgate of claims that everybody is going to sue everybody for false claims, and there's not going to be a really coherent rule. So I think in the near term, it's going to mean some real confusion, although I suspect that Palm would say that confusion is good given that the FDA standard allows Minute Maid to say that they're selling pomegranate juice when they're in fact selling grape apple juice.
It's already confusing enough out there when you go to the grocery store. But anyway, Dahlia Lithwick covering law and the courts for Slate.com. Thanks, Dahlia.
Thank you, Madeline.
It is being called a miracle, the fact that a 16-year-old boy survived after stowing away in the wheel well of an airplane flying from San Jose, California, to Hawaii. The kid ran away from home, hopped the fence at the airport, and then emerged more than 5 hours later, wandering around on the tarmac in Maui. And because of the high altitudes, he was unconscious for much of the journey. But why didn't he freeze to death or fall out of the wheel well over the Pacific or cause a malfunction on the plane itself? I'm joined by Cass Howell. He's an aeronautics expert who can hopefully answer some of these questions. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Well, first, describe what are the typical temperatures and altitude at a cruising altitude? What is that?
Well, it's going to be extraordinarily extreme in terms of what humans can endure. You're talking about at those altitudes, probably 50 to 60 to 70 degrees below zero. So it's going to be something that's never been experienced by any individual typically.
So he's in the wheel well, which is exposed to the elements.
Yeah, he's outside what we call the pressure vessel of the airplane, meaning that there's no place that is heated. There's no place that is oxygen supply. It's a very open and exposed, relatively speaking, part of the airplane in regards to the elements.
So how is it possible that he did not freeze to death?
Well, I'm pretty suspicious about it myself. I have to say that if you, given all the things that have to go right for this to come out with a happy ending, I don't know how he could do it.
You're suspicious of the entire story?
I have some doubts as to whether it happened exactly as been first reported. You know, maybe there's some more to it we don't know yet.
So that it would be pretty much impossible to survive that long at those altitudes.
Let me just describe for you some things that have to go right.
Okay.
And I was trying to think of something that would be a suitable explanation so that people who are not in aviation could relate to it. Imagine a farmer's tractor, the big wheel kind, okay, dragging a whole bunch of very sharp-edged plows. And then imagine your walk-in closet at home. And your walk-in closet, instead of your clothes, has all kinds of things like trash cans and pitchforks and crowbars and just a storage room. Imagine taking off the top of the the room, stuffing that tractor into that room and putting the ceiling back in there, and you're going to be in there without getting crushed or squished?
Hmm.
Not too likely. That's typically what happens whenever the gear comes up. Anybody who's in there is crushed to death or have legs or arms or hands amputated.
Although a teenager in Nigeria did survive a 35-minute trip from Lagos.
It's very difficult. More that you go into an extreme zone, we call the altitudes above 25,000 feet the death zone, and he was well above that for an extended period. So the longer you're up there, the higher you go, the less chance it's going to be successful.
Right. And also to be unconscious for that long also seems unbelievable.
That I can believe, because that's the typical scenario is you do lose consciousness pretty readily. Anything above about 30,000, most likely you are going to lose consciousness for an extended period.
Well, can you describe what the wheel well looks like? What's in it? I was envisioning just an empty sphere, but I understand now that there is all sorts of equipment in there.
It's stuffed full of all kinds of cables, electrical circuitry, batteries. It's a very incredibly complex box that this gear has to fit into, and space is always at a premium, so things are jumbled together, to the layman's eyes, jumbled together. So there's plenty of opportunities to perhaps electrocute yourself by rubbing up against some of the electrical conduits or some things that can amputate fingers and hands just because you're happen to have them there whenever they're operated. So it's all kinds of risk, and you don't really know what you're going to be exposed to if you're 16 years old and jumping up in a wheel well.
Yeah, and could you also cause harm to the plane itself and cause a problem that could cause an accident, potentially?
I don't think that's a big issue. There's certainly a possibility that if your body was crushed into some of the components there that you could disable a system or maybe cause a hydraulic or electrical issue. I don't see that bringing the airplane down, but it certainly would bring it back for probably an unscheduled landing.
Yeah, yeah. So there's no possibility that there's some heat generated from all this equipment and from the air inside the tire itself that could have kept him warm enough to survive?
Like I said, I'm skeptical. Right. I might be proven wrong, but at this point, the odds of it are like 100 to 1 in my guess.
Yeah, or a billion to 1 maybe. Security questions have also been raised by this incident because he just did essentially hop a fence and get into this wheel well, if that indeed happened. What do you make of that?
It's usually not an issue at U.S. airports because they're properly screened and have adequate security. These kinds of incidents happen much more regularly at locations where it's a poor country and you got a young males, that's who it almost always is, trying to find a way to get to some place where they can get work. So that's the scenario that usually happens. But getting into the wheel well is relatively easy if you go to the end of the runway and just wait for an airplane to show up and get ready to take off, because they're always there for a few minutes. And you could scamper up the wheel well and the wheel and get in to that area very quickly and very readily. And at the end of the runway at night, nobody's going to see you.
Cass Howell teaches at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Florida. Thank you for joining us.
Very much a pleasure.
Coming up on the program, we'll talk about how TV series can survive without their creator, Aaron Magruder, no longer working on the animated show he conceived, The Boondocks. Our weekly TV segment with Michael Schneider is coming up next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and it's Monday, which means it's time for our usual TV roundup with Michael Schneider. He's Los Angeles Bureau Chief for TV Guide and co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff. Hi there.
Hey, Madeline.
Well, we had some really, really tragic news last week from Mount Everest. 13 Sherpas killed in an avalanche. And the Discovery Channel said late last night it's going to cancel its live televised stunt from Mount Everest. What did they have planned?
Well, they had planned, actually, it was going to be next month, so this was coming up really fast, where they were going to actually televise a live jump from the top of Everest down the side of the mountain. Jumper Joby Ogwin, I think I'm pronouncing that name correctly, was basically going to free fall from the side of the mountain, and it was going to be a live spectacular event that was going to be telecast on Discovery Channel.
Right, and we've seen several of these live free-falling stunts. Is that ratings gold?
Well, Discovery's been doing a lot of these live events lately where they've had, for example, Daredevil's tightrope across the Grand Canyon. They've got another one crossing skyscrapers in New York coming up. And in this age of social media, these are the kind of events that people are talking about. And if you happen to go on Twitter or Facebook while they're happening, you can't resist tuning in. And it is ratings gold.
Because you're watching it from the perspective of the daredevil, right?
Yeah. And also because it's live, you really don't know how it's going to end. And of course,
which is really
it's morbid. There's that question of what will Discovery do if something happens?
It's a gladiator kind of thing, a little bit.
Yeah. See if you know, this person manages to make it across or perish.
Okay, so something a little less morbid. The Cartoon Network's Adult Swim, a cult favorite, is premiering, and that's the fourth and final season of Boondocks, the cartoon show that features a 10-year-old black militant named Huey Freeman.
What's going on? We're broke, aren't we, Granddad?
I refinanced with that damn adjustable rate mortgage.
How much?
A couple.
1,000?
Million!
Show's back on tonight, and the creative mind, though, behind the show, no longer with the show, Aaron Magruder. What happened?
Yeah, Aaron Magruder, who created the comic strip that, of course, eventually led to the Boondocks, is no longer on the show. And it's still a little mysterious sort of what the circumstances were that led to his departure. We've seen this every once in a while on shows where the creative minds, for whatever reason, be it clash with the network or there's some sort of creative direction that the network wants to go one direction or the studio wants to go one direction and the creator wants to go another direction, leads to this. And unfortunately, that seems to be the case here where Aaron, this is his baby, is no longer involved with the show.
Well, can it be the same show?
Probably the best recent example is Community, where the creator of that show, Dan Harmon, was pushed out after season 3. The show became an entirely different show in season 4, and in an unprecedented move, Sony and NBC, the studio network behind Community, brought Dan Harmon back for season 5. So again, once you have the creative force and really the genius behind a show no longer with the show, it's hard to say whether or not it's still going to be the same, and I think that may be the case with Boondocks.
Okay, another premiere. This one happened on Saturday. It's Orphan Black on BBC America.
An illegal human cloning trial. There's 9 of you.
No, there's only one of me.
One actress, 9 different characters, and this show, it's strange. It's coming from BBC America, and this is very popular.
Well, it's a show that wasn't seen by many people in season 1, but this is a good example of binge viewing, where people actually have been caught up through word of mouth, through social media, et cetera. They've heard about how great the show is, and it's fantastic. Tatiana Maslany, who's the star of the show, does play multiple clones on this series, and she plays up to 9 characters, sometimes characters interacting with each other, and really, all the Emmys should go to Tatiana Maslany. She's incredible, and the fact that she's able to create such unique and distinctive characters where you forget when you're watching Orphan Black that you're watching the same actress playing opposite one another, and these are such defined, interesting, unique characters that you get lost in the fact that it's all the same actress playing these different characters. It's a fantastic show, and I'm so glad and so excited that people are picking up on this, and even though it's on BBC America, it's really sort of getting some mainstream attention now.
All right. Speaking of cloning, perhaps, does Ryan Seacrest clone himself?
So I got up when it was pretty cold and dark this morning, about 5 o'clock. I went and did the local radio show here. Afterwards, I did this syndicated radio show across the country. Then I did the American Top 40 year-end countdown for the contemporary hit radio stations. And then the American Top 40 countdown year-end special for the hot adult contemporary radio stations. And then I did a charity hello to Bob Pittman, the chairman of Clear Channel. And then I had a green juice. I went to the gym. I put on a nice suit, and I came over here to see you.
He's talking to Jimmy Kimmel there. And also, he has another project in the works.
I think Ryan Seacrest has been cloned, basically. But he now has a big deal with Clear Channel, and he's negotiating yet a bigger deal with Clear Channel. He's going to continue to produce other programming for them. He's got a marketing and advertising component with them where he shares revenue with them. He's also continuing to invest in startups. He's got a company that provides seed money to tech companies, and that's going to be a big part of what he's doing with his company and also with Clear Channel. I could just go on. This guy's got basically his hands in virtually anything. He may be invested in your show, Madeline. I'm not sure. You may want to double check.
Maybe you.
Yeah,
and me
exactly.
And
all of us.
Yes. So, okay. Someone else who is multitasking, Michelle Obama, the First Lady. She's going to be on several TV shows soon.
Yeah. This is, The strategy that the White House has been employing to sort of go to the people, go to the masses by going to television. Of course, President Obama was on Between Two Ferns. And Michelle Obama and Dr. Jill Biden have launched this initiative for military families to sort of promote awareness of military families. And to do that now, Michelle Obama is going to be on a number of TV shows coming up toward the end of the season. She's going to be on an episode of Nashville on ABC. She's going to be on an episode of Parks and Recreation, which is on NBC. She's even now reaching the families and the kids. She's going to be on an episode of Jessie, which is a popular tween show comedy on Disney Channel.
So if you are a TV showrunner or a network, can you say no to the First Lady if she calls and says, I want to be on your show?
I think it's hard to say no to the First Lady. And I think you're also thinking that this is still an exclusive group of shows that the First Lady is actually willing to participate and appear on. And that's still a marketing coup for you. So, of course, you're not going to say no if the First Lady wants to show up and be on your show.
You know, Sunday night is primetime viewing night for a lot of big dramas, Game of Thrones, Mad Men, The Good Wife. And it's always hard for people such as myself who don't have cable to get online on Monday or even Sunday night and not be disappointed, not have my viewing spoiled.
Yeah. And it's getting even worse. And, I was on Twitter last night and literally I was about to be spoiled on Mad Men because all the people on the East Coast were starting to tweet about it. And here we are on the West Coast and we're, missing out on some of this. So I had to quickly put my phone down. You do have to be careful.
So is there an honor among thieves in a way? Is there now a spoiler honor system?
Well, yeah, to some degree, I think people are very careful because also you don't want to be called out if you reveal something, especially big moments on, say, Game of Thrones, a big death. If you're the guy who goes on Twitter and spoils it for a number of people. But what is the statute of limitations? Can you talk about something that happened last year on a show? There are some things that people now know about and that you're allowed to talk about. There was a big event I'm even scared now to give away too much. There was a big event last season on Game of Thrones that maybe you still don't want to.
Red Wedding? Really? Even I don't watch Game of Thrones.
Okay.
I know about the Red Wedding.
Yeah. So I guess you could talk about the Red Wedding without specifically saying what happened.
People died.
Yes, lots of people died. Okay. People continue to die. Spoiler alert, people are dying on television. Be careful.
Michael Schneider, LA Bureau Chief for TV Guide and co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff, and that's a podcast downloadable for free at kcrw.com or iTunes. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Madeline.
We want your spoiler stories. Have spoilers affected your personal relationships? How do you react when someone spoils your favorite show? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or head on over to our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, it's A Bug's Life, or A Lot of Bugs' Lives. Scientists launch an ambitious project in the backyards of Los Angeles, trying to find new insect species. We'll have that story after this news update with KCRW's Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, there's nothing cuter than a kitty, right? And we're all concerned about the effects of global warming on the habitat of the polar bear. And yet, most of us don't think twice about spritzing a little bug killer when ants invade our kitchens. Well, there is a new first-of-its-kind study happening right here in Los Angeles, and it just might make you care about a bug's life as much as your favorite furry friends. Reporter Alex Schmidt brings us this story. Hi, Alex.
Hey, Madeline. I have to say, to start off, that personally, I have never been a huge fan of bugs. But when I was looking into the story, I talked with a lot of people who absolutely love them. One of them was Lisa Gonzalez, and she's an entomologist at the Natural History Museum.
I'm really comfortable with bugs. I mean, even more so than that, I absolutely adore bugs, and most bugs that I see, I want to touch them. It's just such a human thing. You want to pick up all bugs. And as a little kid, I could pick them up, and I felt no fear.
I would say that's probably not the usual human reaction, that you want to pick them up.
Absolutely not. She's very unique.
So she does this now for a professional reason.
Yeah, exactly. She's coordinating the study for the museum. For 3 years, they're going to be collecting bugs from all over LA.
And tell us about the study. What are they doing?
So the quickest way to sum it up is that they're looking at how an urban environment affects living creatures. In this case, the living creatures they're looking at are insects, but that could actually tell us a lot more. I talked to Dean Penchef, who's managing the study over at the museum.
What we're really interested in doing is understanding the effect of urbanization on organismal biodiversity. So how is it that we, as we civilize this city and have paved it over, have affected the diversity of the life that lives here? And the tool that we're using to study that is insects.
Dean mentioned the biodiversity of insects. Well, scientists know about 1 million insect species, 1 million. However, they actually estimate there are closer to 10 million.
10 million species?
Yeah, and we don't even know, like, the majority
meaning
of those.
Meaning a gazillion individuals.
Absolutely.
Ooh. Okay, so how could an urban environment affect them?
One way the urban environment affects bugs, they're guessing, is that the bugs are going to adapt to that in all kinds of interesting and unexpected ways, and not only negative ways. So think about toxins, for example. Why is it that some insects would do well among toxins and others wouldn't survive?
Well, you could ask that about any animal. Why insects?
Yeah, you could, but insects are particularly great animals to look at if you want to understand evolution and adaptation to outside factors. They have such short lifespans, so changes to the species happen so much more quickly than they do for large animals like us. So over the course of this study, which is going to be 3 years, scientists will actually be able to see evolution in action.
Wow. So like a mini Galapagos.
Yeah, exactly. You'll be able to watch a species change. And there's another reason that insects tell us a lot about how creatures adapt.
Insects go everywhere. You know, they're sampling our environment for us. If we go out and sample the environment, yeah, we go out with two sensors and scrape three pieces of brick or something like that. But across the insect world, they're everywhere. They're in the air, they're in the soil, they're in the water, they're in the plants.
Sounds like a horror movie. But anyway, the study is sampling insects in the city. Where exactly are they catching them?
That's one of the really cool things about this. It's not scientists that are catching them. It's everyday people. It could even be your neighbor, and it could be happening in your own backyard. So there's 30 homeowners across LA who have volunteered to be part of this study, and their backyards are hosting insect-catching traps for the next 3 years.
And why would they want to do this?
Well, most of them found out about the study through the Natural History Museum, so they're already interested in the natural world. Natalie Breca is one of the people involved, and she lives in Highland Park.
I know this sounds really corny, but if you feel like, we feel really special, actually, to get to be a part of this, because it's just amazing for our city to see what's really here.
And does she and the other participants, do they have to do a lot?
You might think that, but they don't seem to. I mean, they have to change the jars out every week, and they have to keep an eye on the traps, but they just don't seem to mind.
Generally, the maintenance is pretty much nothing, and then we just once a week switch out the bottle. And that does sometimes we forget, and you're like, it's Saturday night, and it's dark outside, and you're like, oh, my God, I forgot to change the bottle. Hurry, go down there. And so, yeah, somebody's down here with a flashlight.
And what is this bottle? What does it look like?
It's a little white jar, basically made out of plastic. And when the bugs are flying along, they hit a black piece of netting and they don't have anywhere to go but up. And as they go up, there's a hole that leads them into a jar of ethanol. And then they fall into the ethanol and die. I have been assured that it is very quick and painless.
Oh, poor bugs. And so what exactly are they catching?
They're catching bees, they're catching flies, they're catching beetles, pretty much anything that can fly. And this is another cool thing about being in the study. You basically get your own personal bug consultant. Lisa, the entomologist I mentioned earlier, she goes to the participants' homes roughly once a month to pick up the jars. And sometimes she brings a sample that she's collected to kind of tell them what's going on in their backyards. She actually went to Natalie Breka's home and did just that. She showed one of the samples to Natalie's daughter.
This is actually one of my favorite groups of flies. They're called flower flies. And these flies are actually really important as pollinators. And in some cases,
it looks like a bee.
Yes, actually, I'm really glad you noticed that because I was going to bring that up, that a lot of them are what we call mimics of bees or wasps, meaning they look just like a bee or they look just like a wasp, but they're not. They're a fly. And they can't sting like a bee or a wasp. So why do you think they would want to look like a bee or look like a wasp?
To try to scare a bug away.
Oh, very good. Exactly, exactly. They're trying to prevent getting eaten or getting bothered by other animals. So far, we've only collected, I want to say, maybe about 3 or 4 of this particular species. But I wanted to bring this one to show you because it's just so beautiful, and this is one from your house.
Well, that's pretty cool. Anything else they're hoping to learn from the study?
Yeah, definitely. This is a pretty new thing they're doing. So here's entomologist Lisa Gonzalez again.
Most of the time when you hear about projects like this, it's in very exotic locations, like in tropical rainforests and faraway places. But to be able to turn that kind of curious eye to our backyards and in our own city is actually very, very unique.
In fact, it's so unique that researchers all over the world are waiting to see what comes out of this study and get their hands on the data, and who knows what they'll discover. This is one of the longest studies ever to look at insects in an urban environment, and they're pretty much certain to discover new species. That's partially because we're in an urban environment. So, you know, think of your own backyard. You might have a tropical rainforest next to a desert, next to a piece of pavement, and all of those different tiny micro ecosystems, if you want to think of them that way, cause insects to adapt in interesting ways.
And have they already discovered new species?
They believe they have, but there's a lot of steps you have to go through to officially announce it. I mean, insects are so incredibly diverse that often there's just one person in the world who can tell you that something is unique. So right now they're in the process of sending specimens all over the world to get that expertise and get them to say, yes, in fact, this is a new species.
So that is really interesting that perhaps one little bug you wouldn't think twice about flying around in your own backyard could actually be, the discovery of it could be advancing science in some way.
So yeah, absolutely. Who knows what it might even bring? I mean, cure for cancer, anything's possible.
Anything's possible. Alex Schmidt, reporter here in LA. She comes to us via KCRW's Independent Producer Project. Alex, thank you.
Thank you.
Come on.
Let's talk about sex, baby.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about it. Let's talk about bug sex, at least. Scientists have discovered a gender-bending insect in Brazil. The female has male genitalia and vice versa. It's perhaps the first example of reversed sex organs in any animal. Professor Marlene Zuck is an evolutionary biologist at the University of Minnesota, and she's the author of the book Sex on Six Legs, Lessons on Life, Love, and Language from the Insect World. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. And tell us more about this intriguing insect. Where does it live and how does it survive? And
so the insects were discovered very recently. And I think one of the great things about this discovery is that it points to exactly what your last little bit was talking about, namely that there's so much about the insect world we don't know and we find all kinds of stuff all the time. And so these are little tiny cave insects and they're mating. Behavior seems surprising to the scientists that watch them because the females actually have an organ that penetrates inside the male and sort of scoops up the sperm from inside the male along with some nutritive stuff that they're getting alongside of it. And so immediately this got dubbed females having a penis and males having a vagina. The males really don't have anything that's analogous to a vagina, and it's also arguable whether the females really have a penis. But for some reason, this does seem to have captured people's imagination.
It certainly captured our imagination here at Press Play. So because it does seem pretty unusual, but you write a lot about the sex lives of bugs, and they're all a lot of them are pretty weird.
Well, absolutely. And what I thought was fun about the study is not so much, and people started arguing about whether, well, is it really a penis? And it's not, of course, a penis in the sense that it's not derived from the same kind of embryonic tissue that a vertebrate penis is. And in fact, in insects, if you really want to be science wonky, you can call it, you can call the male organ, when they do have one, not a real penis, but an ediagus. But that's like way more complicated than most people would really ever care about. So in that sense, you know, sure, it is different from mm-hmm. what we would come to expect. But first of all, actually, there are other animals that have what you might call reverse genitalia. In hyenas, as some listeners might recall, females have an elongated clitoris that it effectively looks like a penis from a distance and is used in sexual communication. They have to give birth through it, which is a process that gives pretty much everyone who ever hears about it pause.
Yeah.
But these cave insects are not necessarily unique. And for me, what the discovery did was suggest that, wow, we really need to remember that animal life is not kind of a 50s situation comedy when it comes to sex roles. A lot of times people say, oh, but biology dictates that females have to be a certain way and males have to be a certain way, and that way is often, you know, kind of an Ozzie and Harriet thing where the guy is dominant and the female is submissive and the female takes care of the kids and the male, you know, goes out and does whatever it is. And, you know, animals aren't all like that.
We have a lot to learn from our insect friends, I think, we in the human world in terms of that. But tell us about this in this particular case. Why is it that the female has this protuberance and scoops up the sperm? Why did it evolve that way? What's in the interest of the animals to do
that?
Well,
so from her perspective, caves are very unusual because there's just not a lot in a cave in the way of things to eat, places to go, things to do. You know, there's no TV in there. And so from a female's perspective, anything she can do that's going to enable her to get as much as she can from the male that will help her, you know, produce her eggs is going to be beneficial. But it's not, you know, that's true in a lot of other circumstances too. Katydids, for instance, which are singing insects, they're the big green ones, they're the relatives of crickets, and you can hear them in the summer singing. In most kinds of katydids, females get this big globby thing along when they mate along with the sperm, and they eat that, and it does kind of the same thing, and they don't have an intermittent organ that helps them you know, grab it up. But I think it just underscores that all of evolution ends up solving the same problem, namely how to leave genes in the next generation in a lot of different ways. And so it's not like, oh, there's only one way to be male and one way to be female. I mean, you can speculate that in these insects, the paucity of food in a cave favored females that could get food in any way they could, and then that, you know, capitalizing perhaps on some mutation that, you know, gave them an early form of the organ, whether we're going to call it a penis or not, was, you know, that was favored. But, you know, the real point is not, you know, you can't always say, oh, okay, and this happened in this situation because there's just a lot of, you know, random stuff that evolution just runs with.
Yeah, yeah. And also, reading the story about this, the duration of the copulation was impressive. Up to 70 hours?
You know, not, well, you have to be, if you're a bug aficionado, it's not so much. So okay, what was it? It was like 50-something hours. Now I can't remember.
That's a long time.
Well, it is, but, you know, there are stick insects that can mate for days.
Hmm. But,
days and days.
But doesn't that leave them open to predation? If
it does. But remember, you know, aforementioned, not much going on in caves. You know, it's not like someone was going to say, and now we really need to stop this because I have a movie I wanted to go see. So, because there's just not.
but why does it take so long? I mean, really, it's not that difficult.
So, actually, yes, joking aside, There's a lot of variation. So scientists study all kinds of weird things. And there is a lot of variation in how long copulation takes in different kinds of animals. And one of the things that's been suggested is that a long duration of copulation means that both partners can't go off and sort of find other mates. And so from the standpoint of the male, it means that the female is going to be more likely to get all of her eggs fertilized by him rather than ditching him, maybe mating with another male, using his sperm instead, and so forth. So it's possible that long copulation durations favor the male.
Oh, fascinating. Marlene Zuck, evolutionary biologist, author of the fantastic book Sex on Six Legs, Lessons on Life, Love, and Language from the Insect World. Lots of lessons to be learned. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, some more lessons here from Warren Olney.
I'd love to think of a segue from the sex life of insects to what's going on in Ukraine, but none comes to mind immediately. We are going to talk about what's going on in Ukraine, and there's plenty. It's a very interesting show, I think, with some characters that really know the territory.
The nationalists aren't stepping down.
Nobody's stepping down. Yeah. Everybody is stepping it up, as it were. And we'll hear a lot about Russian politics and why Putin is doing what he's doing and what his likely goals are. But nobody really knows what's going to happen next. And there's still those 40,000 troops outside the border.
Okay, tune in for that fascinating discussion at 1 o'clock, To the Point with Warren Olney. Thank you. And coming up on this program, when the federal government ended funding for abstinence-only education, it didn't really replace it with clear standards. And so now kids are learning vastly different things about sex depending on where they live. That story is next on Press Play.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Condoms or chastity? Sex ed in this country has swung both ways, and now it's somewhere in between, somewhere murky. Since Congress cut off funding for abstinence-only sex ed 5 years ago, states have implemented their own different standards for teaching sex ed. And the result, it's not really clear what American kids are learning about sex these days. Libby Nelson wrote about all this for Vox. It's a brand new news site. Hi, Libby.
Hi.
Well, let's go back in time, 5 years or so ago. Why did Congress cut off funding for abstinence-only sex ed?
There were two big contributing factors here. First, there was this study in 2007, at really the height of abstinence-only education, that found that abstinence-only sex ed had basically no effect. It didn't necessarily make anything worse, but high school students who were enrolled in abstinence-only sex ed had no difference in when they started having sex, how many sexual partners they had, whether or not they used contraception, any of these things that abstinence only was supposed to affect. It found absolutely no effect at all. So on top of that study, you then had the change in control of Congress. And when the Democrats came in and President Obama came in, there was this swing away from focusing on abstinence as federal policy.
Okay, so now states can qualify for federal sex ed money if they adopt a curriculum that is proven effective, which sounds kind of vague. What does that mean?
Right. Proven effective means that there's been some kind of scientific analysis that finds that, yes, this has an impact on what you want it to have an impact on, that kids delay sex, that they have safer sex, that it has some kind of effect on their sexual behavior.
Okay, so each district, I guess, is free to adopt its own methods for teaching sex ed?
Right, and it's important to note that sex ed actually isn't a requirement nationwide. Most places require at least some form of education about HIV or other sexually transmitted diseases, but not all states require that students get any kind of sex ed at all.
So are some states rebelling against this new policy, this new federal policy?
Certainly, there are a lot of holdouts on the abstinence-only front. There's a good proportion of states who still require that abstinence be stressed in their sex ed curricula, even in places that have tried to go to a more comprehensive form of sex education. There certainly is a lot of local emphasis on abstinence-only. And then you have some states that really have tried to make changes and tried to shift with this shift in the winds of American sex education.
And there's this thing you talk about in your story called National Sexuality Education Standards. What is that?
Right. So the National Sexuality Education Standards are this attempt at some kind of nationwide standardization, some kind of benchmark that all states share for what students should learn about sex, about relationships, about contraception at different grade levels. So the idea is that whether you're in Massachusetts or you're in Mississippi, you will know these things by the end of fifth grade, these things by the end of eighth grade, and these things by the end of high school. That's how it works in theory. In practice, we haven't really seen states jump aboard this bandwagon of nationally recognized sex education knowledge.
And why is that?
I think it's a lot of things. They got caught up, first of all, in the backlash over other national standards for reading and math, the Common Core. The sex ed standards aren't part of the Common Core. They're not associated with the Common Core. But as there's been this backlash, we've seen a skepticism of any kind of common standards or standards that are shared from state to state. The other thing is you take that already sort of controversial idea and you throw in sex ed, which has to be one of the most controversial subjects in American education. There are just a lot of different ideas from state to state and even from district to district about what kids should learn and when it should be taught and how.
And why is it controversial, or why aren't states interested in adopting these standards?
I think it's quite a few things. Sex ed in general is something that runs up against religious ideas, ideas about what parents should or shouldn't be teaching their kids. It's not a topic that legislators are necessarily comfortable fiddling around in, and it's a topic even more so than most in education, where the idea of local control and that communities know what's best for their kids is very strong. The other thing is it's just not seen as a national imperative the way that reading and math are. When you look at something like the Common Core, there is this national anxiety that American students aren't doing as well as students are doing internationally. There are no standardized tests for sex ed. There's no way of knowing necessarily what kids do and don't know. There are some surveys, but there's nothing official. And so there isn't really this feeling of an educational crisis that you maybe get with other subject matter areas.
But what about these standards themselves that are not being adopted? Is there anything within them? What's in them, first of all, and anything that would raise eyebrows?
Yeah, they're very comprehensive. The biggest change that they make is they take sex ed away from this thing that you add on for a month or a couple of, you know, a few weeks or maybe even a semester. And they really try to make sexual development, healthy relationships, part of the curriculum all the way from second grade on up. So in second grade, it's things like students should know how to name their body parts scientifically, but they also should understand issues around bullying and things that we don't necessarily think of as sex per se, but have to do with interpersonal relationships. They're very friendly toward LGBT students and the LGBT population. One of the eighth grade standards is differentiating between sexual orientation and gender identity. And there's this idea of equality and advocating for equality throughout, which obviously would raise some eyebrows in some more socially conservative places. And they require a pretty thorough knowledge of contraception, including emergency contraception like Plan B, which has been certainly a controversial issue politically in all kinds of ways, let alone in sex education.
Right. So people are saying, people maybe who are more conservative are saying that you're teaching girls to have abortions or you're teaching
right,
kids
exactly.
to have sex rather than to abstain from sex.
Exactly. And abstinence is also in there. One of the standards is being able to explain why you choose to abstain from sex, but it is not emphasized in the way that it would have been in the past.
Okay. So where does that leave us? Does that leave us with every district is teaching sex ed differently, and some students are learning all of that, which you just mentioned, and some students are learning only about abstinence, and it's just this crazy hodgepodge across the country?
Absolutely. And it's important to point out that isn't unusual in American education. Really, even in more basic and less controversial subjects like reading and math, you saw a patchwork of state standards until very recently. So crazy hodgepodge is a pretty good way to put it. What a student's learning in Mississippi could be very different from what a student's learning in California.
Libby Nelson reports on education for Vox. It's a new online news site. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
right, bringing her own crazy hodgepodge of letters, email, voicemail.
It is.
Jolie Myers is here.
A total hodgepodge. In an update to a story we did on Friday, a very, very hard-hitting look at parking tickets in Los Angeles.
That really struck a nerve.
It not only did it strike a nerve, I think it doomed me because I got a parking ticket.
Oh yeah, you were bragging that you hadn't received one.
I was bragging that I had not received one in the first 4 months of the year, thinking I could cruise through without a parking ticket. Not so fast, Julie. That was hubris. That was flying too close to the sun.
Your wings were singed.
Ticketed at approximately 8:07 on Saturday morning. You're welcome, LA.
Wow, they work early on Saturday mornings.
They do.
For us.
Well, we talked about TV earlier in the show, and spoilers. We talked about spoilers, and I think that we're at peak spoiler at this point. I do. I think that it is, we're at spoiler saturation. And the worst is that even when people aren't completely blowing it on Facebook and Twitter, like giving away the exact thing, they're all hinting around it. And it's like, you know, something's going
to
happen.
It's because we all want to talk about it, but we can't.
We
used to all be able to talk about who shot JR.
Right, right. It used to be a water cooler thing, and now the digital water cooler is 24/7. So you even know it's going to happen. But candidly, Lizzie on our Facebook page offered a defense of spoilers.
Mm-hmm.
Really. She seeks them out. She says she doesn't like unpleasant surprises, a sad movie ending, or any sort of red wedding situation. So she has her friends warn her if anything like that is on the way. She does like happy surprises, though, so she only takes the bummer spoilers and not the happy ones.
You can't unsee something, though.
You can't unsee it.
Yeah.
You can't. But Eric Allen points out that there's an app for that. He's got something on his phone called Spoiler Shield, which blocks spoiler mentions from your social media field until you've seen the show. So if somebody says something like King's Landing or Khaleesi on Facebook, redacted. And I need to go ahead and I'll be back in just a sec. I need to go ahead and download that. But over on Twitter, Loie Murray says the true mark of a great TV show is when the big surprises have been spoiled and you still want to tune in.
Okay. Even though we know who shot JR, we still tune in. Okay. Thank you, Jolie Myers, for bringing us that. And if you want to weigh in on anything you've heard on the program or anything at all, our voicemail is 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Our Twitter, at KCRW, press play. I am at The Mad Brand. We're also on Facebook. And thanks a lot for listening. Warren Olney is up next with To The Point. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.